This is Audible.
Red Harvest by Dashiell Hammett, narrated by Richard Ferrone. Chapter 1. A Woman in Green and a Man in Gray. I first heard Personville called Poisonville by a red-haired mucker named Hickey Dewey in the big ship in Butte. He also called his shirt a shoit. I didn't think anything of what he had done to the city's name. Later, I heard men who could manage their R's give it the same pronunciation. I still didn't see anything in it but the meaningless sort of humor that used to make Richard's Nary the thieves' word for dictionary. A few years later, I went to Personville and learned better. Using one of the phones in the station, I called the Herald, asked for Donald Wilson, and told him I had arrived. "Will you come out to my house at 10 this evening?" He had a pleasantly crisp voice. "It's 2101 Mountain Boulevard. Take a Broadway car, get off at Laurel Avenue, and walk 2 blocks west." I promised to do that. Then I rode up to the Great Western Hotel, dumped my bags, and went out to look at the city. The city wasn't pretty. Most of its builders had gone in for gaudiness. Maybe they had been successful at first. Since then, the smelters whose brick stacks stuck up tall against a gloomy mountain to the south had yellow-smoked everything into uniform dinginess. The result was an ugly city of 40,000 people set in an ugly notch between two ugly mountains that had been all dirtied up by mining. Spread over this was a grimy sky that looked as if it had come out of the smelter's stacks. The first policeman I saw needed a shave. The second had a couple of buttons off his shabby uniform. The third stood in the center of the city's main intersection, Broadway and Union Street, directing traffic with a cigar in one corner of his mouth. After that, I stopped checking them up. At 9:30, I caught a Broadway car and followed the directions Donald Wilson had given me. They brought me to a house set in a hedged grass plot on a corner. The maid who opened the door told me Mr. Wilson was not home. While I was explaining that I had an appointment with him, a slender blonde woman of something less than 30 in green crepe came to the door. When she smiled, her blue eyes didn't lose their stoniness. I repeated my explanation to her. "My husband isn't in now." A barely noticeable accent slurred her S's. "But if he's expecting you, he'll probably be home shortly." She took me upstairs to a room on the Laurel Avenue side of the house, a brown and red room with a lot of books in it. We sat in leather chairs, half facing each other, half facing a burning coal grate, and she set about learning my business with her husband. "Do you live in Personville?" she asked first.
"No, San Francisco."
"But this isn't your first visit?"
"Yes."
"Really? How do you like our city?"
"I haven't seen enough of it to know." That was a lie. I had. "I got in only this afternoon." Her shiny eyes stopped prying while she said,
"You'll find it a dreary place."
She returned to her digging with,
"I suppose all mining towns are like this. Are you engaged in mining?"
"Not just now." She looked at the clock on the mantel and said,
"It's inconsiderate of Donald to bring you out here and then keep you waiting at this time of night, long after business hours."
I said that was all right.
"Though perhaps it isn't a business matter," she suggested.
I didn't say anything. She laughed, a short laugh with something sharp in it.
"I'm really not ordinarily so much of a busybody as you probably think," she said gaily. "But you're so excessively secretive that I can't help being curious. You aren't a bootlegger, are you? Donald changes them so often."
I let her get whatever she could out of a grin. A telephone bell rang downstairs. Mrs. Wilson stretched her green-slippered feet out toward the burning coal and pretended she hadn't heard the bell. I didn't know why she thought that necessary. She began,
"I'm afraid I'll have..."
and stopped to look at the maid in the doorway. The maid said Mrs. Wilson was wanted at the phone. She excused herself and followed the maid out. She didn't go downstairs, but spoke over an extension within earshot. I heard,
"Mrs. Wilson speaking."
"Yes."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Who?"
"Can't you speak a little louder?"
"What?"
"Yes, yes.
Who is this? Hello, hello?"
The telephone hook rattled. Her steps sounded down the hallway, rapid steps. I set fire to a cigarette and stared at it until I heard her going down the steps. Then I went to a window, lifted an edge of the blind, and looked out at Laurel Avenue and at the square white garage that stood in the rear of the house on that side. Presently, a slender woman in dark coat and hat came into sight hurrying from house to garage. It was Mrs. Wilson. She drove away in a black coupe. I went back to my chair and waited. 3/4 of an hour went by. At 11:05, automobile brakes screeched outside. 2 minutes later, Mrs. Wilson came into the room. She had taken off her hat and coat. Her face was white, her eyes almost black.
"I'm awfully sorry,"
she said, her tight-lipped mouth moving jerkily.
"But you've had all this waiting for nothing. My husband won't be home tonight."
I said I would get in touch with him at the Herald in the morning. I went away wondering why the green toe of her left slipper was dark and damp with something that could have been blood. I walked over to Broadway and caught a streetcar. 3 blocks north of my hotel, I got off to see what the crowd was doing around a side entrance of the City Hall. 30 or 40 men and a sprinkling of women stood on the sidewalk looking at a door marked Police Department. There were men from mines and smelters still in their working clothes, gaudy boys from pool rooms and dance halls, sleek men with slick pale faces, men with the dull look of respectable husbands, a few just as respectable and dull women, and some ladies of the night. On the edge of this congregation, I stopped beside a square-set man in rumpled gray clothes. His face was grayish, too, even the thick lips, though he wasn't much older than 30. His face was broad, thick-featured, and intelligent. For color, he depended on a red Windsor tie that blossomed over his gray flannel shirt. "What's the rumpus?" I asked him. He looked at me carefully before he replied, as if he wanted to be sure that the information was going to be in safe hands. His eyes were gray as his clothes, but not so soft. "Don Wilson's gone to sit at the right hand of God, if God don't mind looking at bullet holes." "Who shot him?" I asked. The gray man scratched the back of his neck and said, "Somebody with a gun." I wanted information, not wit. I would have tried my luck with some other member of the crowd if the red tie hadn't interested me. I said, "I'm a stranger in town. Hang the Punch and Judy on me. That's what strangers are for. Donald Wilson, Esquire, publisher of the Morning and Evening Heralds, was found in Hurricane Street a little while ago, shot very dead by parties unknown," he recited in a rapid sing-song. "Does that keep your feelings from being hurt?" "Thanks." I put out a finger and touched the loose end of his tie. "Mean anything, or just wearing it?"
"I'm Bill Quint."
"The hell you are," I exclaimed, trying to place the name.
"By God, I'm glad to meet you."
I dug out my card case and ran through the collection of credentials I had picked up here and there by one means or another. The red card was the one I wanted. It identified me as Henry F. Neal, A.B. Seaman, member in good standing of the Industrial Workers of the World. There wasn't a word of truth in it. I passed this card to Bill Quint. He read it carefully, front and back, returned it to my hand, and looked me over from hat to shoes, not trustfully.
"He's not gonna die anymore," he said. "Which way you going?"
"Any." We walked down the street together, turned a corner, aimlessly as far as I knew.
"What brought you in here, if you're a sailor?" he asked casually.
"Where'd you get that idea?"
"There's the card."
"I got another that proves I'm a timber beast," I said. "If you want me to be a miner, I'll get one for that tomorrow."
"You won't. I run 'em here." Suppose you got a wire from Shy, I asked. Hell with Shy, I run him here. He nodded at a restaurant door and asked, drink? Only when I can get it. We went through the restaurant, up a flight of steps, and into a narrow second-story room with a long bar and a row of tables. Bill Quint nodded and said hello to some of the boys and girls at tables and bar, and steered me into one of the green-curtained booths that lined the wall opposite the bar. We spent the next 2 hours drinking whiskey and talking. The gray man didn't think I had any right to the card I had showed him, nor to the other one I had mentioned. He didn't think I was a good wobbly. As chief muckety-muck of the IWW in Personville, he considered it his duty to get the lowdown on me and to not let himself be pumped about radical affairs while he was doing it. That was all right with me. I was interested in Personville affairs. He didn't mind discussing them between casual pokings into my business with the red cards. What I got out of him amounted to this. For 40 years, old Elihu Wilson, father of the man who had been killed this night, had owned Personville, heart, soul, skin, and guts. He was president and majority stockholder of the Personville Mining Corporation, ditto of the First National Bank, owner of the Morning Herald and Evening Herald, the city's only newspapers, and at least part owner of nearly every other enterprise of any importance. Along with these pieces of property, he owned a United States senator, a couple of representatives, the governor, the mayor, and most of the state legislature. Elihu Wilson was Personville, and he was almost the whole state. Back in the war days, the IWW, in full bloom then throughout the West, had lined up the Personville Mining Corporation's help. The help hadn't been exactly pampered. They used their new strength to demand the things they wanted. Old Elihu gave them what he had to give them and bided his time. In 1921, it came. Business was rotten. Old Elihu didn't care whether he shut down for a while or not. He tore up the agreements he had made with his men and began kicking them back into their pre-war circumstances. Of course, the help yelled for help. Bill Quint was sent out from IWW headquarters in Chicago to give them some action. He was against a strike, an open walkout. He advised the old sabotage racket, staying on the job and gumming things up from the inside. But that wasn't active enough for the Personville crew. They wanted to put themselves on the map, make labor history. They struck. The strike lasted 8 months. Both sides bled plenty. The Wobblies had to do their own bleeding. Old Elihu hired gunmen, strikebreakers, National Guardsmen, and even parts of the regular army to do his. When the last skull had been cracked, the last rib kicked in, organized labor in Personville was a used firecracker. But, said Bill Quint, old Elihu didn't know his Italian history. He won the strike, but he lost his hold on the city and the state. To beat the miners, he had to let his hired thugs run wild. When the fight was over, he couldn't get rid of them. He had given his city to them, and he wasn't strong enough to take it away from them. Personville looked good to them, and they took it over. They had won his strike for him, and they took the city for their spoils. He couldn't openly break with them. They had too much on him. He was responsible for all they had done during the strike. Bill Quint and I were both fairly mellow by the time we had got this far. He emptied his glass again, pushed his hair out of his eyes, and brought his history up to date. The strongest of them now is probably Pete the Finn. This stuff we're drinking's his. Then there's Lou Yard. He's got a loan shop down on Parker Street. Does a lot of bail bond business, handles most of the Berg's hot stuff, so they tell me, and is pretty thick with Noonan, the chief of police. This kid Max Thaler, Whisper, had got a lot of friends too, a slick, dark guy with something wrong with his throat, can't talk, gambler. Those three, with Noonan, just about help Elihu run this city, help him more than he wants. But he's got to play with them or else. This fellow who was knocked off tonight, Elihu's son, where did he stand? I asked. Where Papa put him, And he's where Papa put him now.
You mean the old man had him? Maybe. But that's not my guess. This Don just came home and began running the papers for the old man. It wasn't like the old devil, even if he was getting close to the grave, to let anybody cop anything from him without hitting back. But he had to be cagey with these guys. He brought the boy and his French wife home from Paris and used him for his monkey. A damn nice fatherly trick. Don starts a reform campaign in the papers. Clear the burg of vice and corruption, which means clear it of Pete and Lou and Whisper if it goes far enough. Get it? The old man's using the boy to shake 'em loose. I guess they got tired of being shook.
There seems to be a few things wrong with that guess, I said.
There's more than a few things wrong with everything in this lousy burg. Had enough of this paint?
I said I had. We went down to the street. Bill Quint told me he was living in the Miners' Hotel in Forest Street. His way home ran past my hotel, so we walked down together. In front of my hotel, a beefy fellow with the look of a plainclothesman stood on the curb and talked to the occupant of a Stutz touring car.
"That's Whisper in the car," Bill Quint told me.
I looked past the beefy man and saw Thaler's profile. It was young, dark, and small, with pretty features as regular as if they had been cut by a die.
"He's cute," I said.
"Uh-huh," the gray man agreed.
"And so's Dynamite."
Chapter 2. The Czar of Poisonville. The Morning Herald gave 2 pages to Donald Wilson and his death. His picture showed a pleasant, intelligent face with curly hair, smiling eyes and mouth, a cleft chin, and a striped necktie. The story of his death was simple. At 10:40 the previous night, he had been shot 4 times in stomach, chest, and back, dying immediately. The shooting had taken place in the 1100 block of Hurricane Street. Residents of that block who looked out after hearing the shots saw the dead man lying on the sidewalk. A man and a woman were bending over him. The street was too dark for anyone to see anybody or anything clearly. The man and woman had disappeared before anybody else reached the street. Nobody knew what they looked like. Nobody had seen them go away. 6 shots had been fired at Wilson from a .32-caliber pistol. 2 of them had missed him, going into the front wall of a house. Tracing the course of these 2 bullets, the police had learned that the shooting had been done from a narrow alley across the street. That was all anybody knew. Editorially, the Morning Herald gave a summary of the dead man's short career as a civic reformer and expressed a belief that he had been killed by some of the people who didn't want Personville cleaned up. The Herald said the chief of police could best show his own lack of complicity by speedily catching and convicting the murderer or murderers. The editorial was blunt and bitter. I finished it with my 2nd cup of coffee, jumped a Broadway car, dropped off at Laurel Avenue, and turned down toward the dead man's house. I was 1/2 block from it when something changed my mind and my destination. A smallish young man in 3 shades of brown crossed the street ahead of me. His dark profile was pretty. He was Max Thaler, alias Whisper. I reached the corner of Mountain Boulevard in time to catch the flash of his brown-covered rear leg vanishing into the late Donald Wilson's doorway. I went back to Broadway, found a drugstore with a phone booth in it, searched the directory for Elihu Wilson's residence number, called it, told somebody who claimed to be the old man's secretary that I had been brought from San Francisco by Donald Wilson, that I knew something about his death, and that I wanted to see his father. When I made it emphatic enough, I got an invitation to call. The Czar of Poisonville was propped up in bed when his secretary, a noiseless, slim, sharp-eyed man of 40, brought me into the bedroom. The old man's head was small and almost perfectly round under its close-cut crop of white hair. His ears were too small and plastered too flat to the sides of his head to spoil the spherical effect. His nose also was small, carrying down the curve of his bony forehead. Mouth and chin were straight lines chopping the sphere off.
Below them, a short, thick neck ran down into white pajamas between square, meaty shoulders. One of his arms was outside the covers, a short, compact arm that ended in a thick-fingered, blunt hand. His eyes were round, blue, small, and watery. They looked as if they were hiding behind the watery film and under the bushy white brows, only until the time came to jump out and grab something. He wasn't the sort of man whose pocket you'd try to pick unless you had a lot of confidence in your fingers. He ordered me into a bedside chair with a 2-inch jerk of his round head, chased the secretary away with another, and asked, "What's this about my son?" His voice was harsh. His chest had too much and his mouth too little to do with his words for them to be very clear. "I'm a Continental Detective Agency operative, San Francisco branch," I told him. "A couple of days ago, we got a check from your son and a letter asking that a man be sent here to do some work for him. I'm the man. He told me to come out to his house last night. I did, but he didn't show up. When I got downtown, I learned he had been killed." Elihu Wilson peered suspiciously at me and asked, "Well, what of it?" "While I was waiting, your daughter-in-law got a phone message, went out, came back with what looked like blood on her shoe, and told me her husband wouldn't be home. He was shot at 10:40. She went out at 10:20, came back at 11:05. The old man sat straight up in bed and called young Mrs. Wilson a flock of things. When he ran out of words of that sort, he still had some breath left. He used it to shout at me.
"Is she in jail?"
I said I didn't think so. He didn't like her not being in jail. He was nasty about it. He bawled a lot of things I didn't like, winding up with,
"What the hell are you waiting for?"
He was too old and too sick to be smacked. I laughed and said, "For evidence."
"Evidence? What do you need? You've..."
"Don't be a chump," I interrupted his bawling. "Why should she kill him?"
"Because she's a French hussy. Because she..."
The secretary's frightened face appeared at the door.
"Get out of here!"
The old man roared at it, and the face went. "She jealous?" I asked before he could go on with his shouting. "And if you don't yell, maybe I'll be able to hear you anyway. My deafness is a lot better since I've been eating yeast." He put a fist on top of each hump his thighs made in the covers and pushed his square chin at me.
"Old as I am, and sick as I am," he said very deliberately, "I've a great mind to get up and kick your behind."
I paid no attention to that, repeating, "Was she jealous?"
"She was," he said, not yelling now. "And domineering. And spoiled, and suspicious, and greedy, and mean, and unscrupulous, and deceitful, and selfish, and damned bad. Altogether damned bad."
"Any reason for her jealousy?"
"I hope so," he said bitterly. "I'd hate to think a son of mine would be faithful to her, though likely enough he was. He'd do things like that."
"But you don't know any reason why she should have killed him?"
"Don't know any reason?" he was bellowing again. "Haven't I been telling you that—"
"Yeah, but none of that means anything. It's kind of childish." The old man flung the covers back from his legs and started to get out of bed. Then he thought better of it, raised his red face, and roared,
"Stanley!"
The door opened to let the secretary glide in.
"Throw this bastard out,"
his master ordered, waving a fist at me. The secretary turned to me. I shook my head and suggested, "Better get help." He frowned. We were about the same age. He was weedy, nearly a head taller than I, but 50 pounds lighter. Some of my 190 pounds were fat, but not all of them. The secretary fidgeted, smiled apologetically, and went away. "What I was about to say," I told the old man. "I intended talking to your son's wife this morning, but I saw Max Thaler go into the house, so I postponed my visit." Elihu Wilson carefully pulled the covers up over his legs again, leaned his head back on the pillows, screwed his eyes up at the ceiling, and said,
So that's the way it is it?
Mean anything?
She killed him, he said certainly. That's what it means.
Feet made noises in the hall, huskier feet than the secretary's. When they were just outside the door, I began a sentence. You were using your son to run a...
Get out of here!
The old man yelled at those in the doorway.
And keep that door closed!
He glowered at me and demanded,
What was I using my son for?
To put the knife in Thaler, Yard, and the Finn.
You're a liar.
I didn't invent the story. It's all over Personville.
It's a lie. I gave him the papers. He did what he wanted with them.
You ought to explain that to your playmates. They'd believe you.
What they believe be damned. What I'm telling you is so.
What of it? Your son won't come back to life just because he was killed by mistake, if he was.
That woman killed him.
Maybe.
Damn you and your maybes. She did.
Maybe. But the other angle has got to be looked into, too, the political end. You can tell me.
I can tell you that that French hussy killed him, and I can tell you that any other damned numbskull notions you've got are way off the load.
But they've got to be looked into, I insisted. And you know the inside of Personville politics better than anyone else I'm likely to find. He was your son. The least you can do is...
The least I can do, he bellowed, is tell you to get the hell back to Frisco, you and your numbskull.
I got up and said unpleasantly, I'm at the Great Western Hotel. Don't bother me unless you want to talk sense for a change. I went out of the bedroom and down the stairs. The secretary hovered around the bottom step, smiling apologetically.
A fine old rowdy, I growled.
A remarkably vital personality, he murmured. At the office of the Herald, I hunted up the murdered man's secretary. She was a small girl of 19 or 20 with wide chestnut eyes, light brown hair, and a pale pretty face. Her name was Lewis. She said she hadn't known anything about my being called to Personville by her employer.
But then, she explained, Mr. Wilson always liked to keep everything to himself as long as he could. It was... I don't think he trusted anybody here, completely.
Not you? She flushed and said.
No, but of course he had been here such a short while and didn't know any of us very well.
There must have been more to it than that.
Well,
she bit her lip and made a row of forefinger prints down the polished edge of the dead man's desk.
His father wasn't in sympathy with what he was doing. Since his father really owned the papers, I suppose it was natural for Mr. Donald to think that some of the employees might be more loyal to Mr. Elihu than to him.
The old man wasn't in favor of the reform campaign? Why did he stand for it if the papers were his? She bent her head to study the fingerprints she had made. Her voice was low.
It's not easy to understand unless you know. The last time Mr. Elihu was taken sick, he sent for Donald. Mr. Donald. Mr. Donald had lived in Europe most of his life, you know. Dr. Pride told Mr. Elihu that he'd have to give up the management of his affairs, so he cabled his son to come home. But when Mr. Donald got here, Mr. Elihu couldn't make up his mind to let go of everything. But he wanted Mr. Donald to stay here, so he gave him the newspapers. That is, made him publisher. Mr. Donald liked that. He had been interested in journalism in Paris. When he found out how terrible everything was here, in civic affairs and so on, he started that reform campaign. He didn't know. He had been away since he was a boy. He didn't know.
He didn't know his father was in it as deep as anybody else. I helped her along. She squirmed a little over her examination of the fingerprints, didn't contradict me, and went on.
Mr. Elihu and he had a quarrel. Mr. Elihu told him to stop stirring things up, but he wouldn't stop. Maybe he would have stopped if he had known all there was to know. But I don't suppose it would have occurred to him that his father was really seriously implicated. And his father wouldn't tell him. I suppose it would be hard for a father to tell a son a thing like that. He threatened to take the papers away from Mr. Donald. I don't know whether he intended to or not, but he was taken sick again, and everything went along as it did.
Donald Wilson didn't confide in you? I asked.
No.
It was almost a whisper. Then you learned all this where?
I'm trying to help you learn who murdered him, she said earnestly. You have no right to...
You'll help me most just now by telling me where you learned all this, I insisted. She stared at the desk, chewing her lower lip. I waited. Presently, she said,
My father is Mr. Wilson's secretary.
Thanks.
But you mustn't think that we...
It's nothing to me, I assured her. What was Wilson doing in Hurricane Street last night when he had a date with me at his house? She said she didn't know. I asked her if she had heard him tell me, over the phone, to come to his house at 10 o'clock. She said she had. What did he do after that? Try to remember every least thing that was said and done from then until you left at the end of the day. She leaned back in her chair, shut her eyes, and wrinkled her forehead.
You called up, if it was you he told to come to his house, at about 2 o'clock. After that, Mr. Donald dictated some letters, one to a paper mill, one to Senator Kiefer about some changes in post office regulations, and... Oh, yes. He went out for about 20 minutes, a little before 3, and before he went, he wrote out a check.
Who for?
I don't know, but I saw him writing it.
Where's his checkbook? Carry it with him?
It's here.
She jumped up, went around to the front of his desk, and tried the top drawer.
Locked.
I joined her, straightened out a wire clip, and with that and a blade of my knife, fiddled the drawer open. The girl took out a thin, flat First National Bank checkbook. The last used stub was marked $5,000, nothing else. No name, no explanation. He went out with his check, I said, and was gone 20 minutes. Long enough to get to the bank and back.
It wouldn't have taken him more than 5 minutes to get there.
Did anything else happen before he wrote out the check? Think. Any messages, letters, phone calls?
Let's see.
She shut her eyes again.
He was dictating some mail and... Oh, how stupid of me. He did have a phone call. He said, Yes, I can be there at 10, but I shall have to hurry away. Then again, he said, very well, at 10. That was all he said, except yes, yes, several times.
Talking to a man or a woman?
I didn't know.
Think. There'd be a difference in his voice. She thought and said,
Then it was a woman.
Which of you, you or he, left first in the evening?
I did. I told you my father is Mr. Elihu's secretary. He and Mr. Donald had an engagement for the early part of the evening. Something about the paper's finances. Father came in a little after 5. They were going to dinner together, I think.
That was all the Lewis girl could give me. She knew nothing that would explain Wilson's presence in the 1100 block of Hurricane Street, she said. She admitted knowing nothing about Mrs. Wilson. We frisked the dead man's desk and dug up nothing in any way informative. I went up against the girls at the switchboard and learned nothing. I put in an hour's work on messengers, city editors, and the like, and my pumping brought up nothing. The dead man, as his secretary said, had been a good hand at keeping his affairs to himself. Chapter 3. Dinah Brand. At the First National Bank, I got hold of an assistant cashier named Albury, a nice-looking blonde youngster of 25 or so.
I certified the check from Mr. Wilson,
he said after I had explained what I was up to.
It was drawn to the order of Dinah Brand.
$5,000.
Know who she is? Oh, yes, I know her. Mind telling me what you know about her? Not at all. I'd be glad to, but I'm already 8 minutes overdue at a meeting with... Can you have dinner with me this evening and give it to me then? That'll be fine, he said. 7 o'clock at the Great Western? Righto. I'll run along and let you get to your meeting, but tell me, has she an account here?
Yes, and she deposited the check this morning. The police have it.
Yeah? And where does she live?
1232 Hurricane Street.
I said, well, well, and said, see you tonight, and went away. My next stop was in the office of the chief of police in the city hall. Noonan, the chief, was a fat man with twinkling greenish eyes set in a round, jovial face. When I told him what I was doing in his city, he seemed glad of it. He gave me a handshake, a cigar, and a chair.
Now, he said when we were settled, tell me who turned the trick.
The secret's safe with me.
You and me both, he said cheerfully through smoke. But what do you guess?
I'm not good at guessing, especially when I haven't got the facts.
'Twon't take long to give you all the facts there is, he said. Wilson got a 5 grand check in Dinah Brand's name certified yesterday, just before bank closing. Last night, he was killed by slugs from a .32 less than a block from her house. People that heard the shooting saw a man and a woman bending over the remains. Bright and early this morning, the said Dinah Brand deposits the said check in the said bank.
Well? Who is this Dinah Brand? The chief dumped the ash off his cigar in the center of his desk, flourished the cigar in his fat hand, and said, a soiled dove, as the fella says. A deluxe hustler. A big league gold digger. Gone up against her yet?
No. There's a couple of slants to be taken care of first. We're keeping an eye on her and waiting. This, I've told you, is under the hat.
Yeah. Now, listen to this. And I told him what I had seen and heard while waiting in Donald Wilson's house the previous night. When I had finished, the chief bunched his fat mouth, whistled softly, and exclaimed,
Man, that's an interesting thing you've been telling me. So it was blood on her slipper? And she said her husband wouldn't be home?
That's what I took it for, I said to the first question, and, yeah, to the second.
Have you done any talking to her since then? He asked.
No. I was up that way this morning, but a young fellow named Thaler went into the house ahead of me, so I put off my visit.
Grease us twice.
His greenish eyes glittered happily.
Are you telling me the Whisper was there?
Yeah. He threw his cigar on the floor, stood up, planted his fat hands on the desktop, and leaned over them toward me, oozing delight from every pore.
Man, you've done something, he purred. Dinah Brand is this Whisper's woman. Let's me and you just go out and kind of talk to the widow.
We climbed out of the chief's car in front of Mrs. Wilson's residence. The chief stopped for a second with 1 foot on the bottom step to look at the black crepe hanging over the bell. Then he said,
Well, what's got to be done has got to be done.
And we went up the steps. Mrs. Wilson wasn't anxious to see us, but people usually see the chief of police if he insists. This one did. We were taken upstairs to where Donald Wilson's widow sat in the library. She was in black. Her blue eyes had frost in them. Noonan and I took turns mumbling condolences, and then he began.
We just wanted to ask you a couple of questions. For instance, like where you'd go last night.
She looked disagreeably at me, then back to the chief, frowned, and spoke haughtily.
May I ask why I am being questioned in this manner?
I wondered how many times I had heard that question, word for word and tone for tone, while the chief, disregarding it, went on amiably.
And then there was something about one of your shoes being stained. The right one, or maybe the left. Anyways, it was one or the other.
A muscle began twitching in her upper lip.
"Was that all?" the chief asked me.
Before I could answer, he made a clucking noise with his tongue and turned his genial face to the woman again.
"I almost forgot. There was a matter of how you knew your husband wouldn't be home."
She got up unsteadily, holding the back of her chair with one white hand.
"I'm sure you'll excuse..."
"It's all right." The chief made a big-hearted gesture with one beefy paw. "We don't want to bother you. Just where you went, and about the shoe, and how you knew he wasn't coming back. And, come to think of it, there's another, what Thaler wanted here this morning."
Mrs. Wilson sat down again, very rigidly. The chief looked at her. A smile that tried to be tender made funny lines and humps in his fat face. After a little while, her shoulders began to relax, her chin went lower, a curve came in her back. I put a chair facing her and sat on it.
"You'll have to tell us, Mrs. Wilson," I said, making it as sympathetic as I could. "These things have got to be explained."
"Do you think I have anything to hide?"
she asked defiantly, sitting up straight and stiff again, turning each word out very precisely, except that the S's were a bit slurred.
"I did go out. The stain was blood. I knew my husband was dead. Thaler came to see me about my husband's death. Are your questions answered now?"
"We knew all that," I said. "We're asking you to explain them." She stood up again, said angrily,
"I dislike your manner. I refuse to submit to..."
Noonan said,
"That's perfectly all right, Mrs. Wilson.
Only we'll have to ask you to go down to the hall with us."
She turned her back to him, took a deep breath, and threw words at me.
"While we were waiting here for Donald, I had a telephone call. It was a man who wouldn't give his name. He said Donald had gone to the home of a woman named Dinah Brand with a check for $5,000. He gave me her address. Then I drove out there and waited down the street in the car until Donald came out. While I was waiting there, I saw Max Thaler, whom I knew by sight. He went to the woman's house, but didn't go in. He went away. Then Donald came out and walked down the street. He didn't see me. I didn't want him to. I intended to drive home, get here before he came. I had just started the engine when I heard the shots, and I saw Donald fall. I got out of the car and ran over to him. He was dead. I was frantic. Then Thaler came. He said if I were found there, they would say I had killed him. He made me run back to the car and drive home."
Tears were in her eyes. Through the water, her eyes studied my face, apparently trying to learn how I took the story. I didn't say anything, she asked.
"Is that what you wanted?"
"Practically," Noonan said. He had walked around to one side. "What did Thaler say this afternoon?"
"He urged me to keep quiet."
Her voice had become small and flat.
"He said either or both of us would be suspected if anyone learned we were there, because Donald had been killed coming from the woman's house after giving her money."
"Where did the shots come from?" the chief asked.
"I don't know. I didn't see anything, except when I looked up, Donald falling."
"Did Thaler fire them?"
"No,"
she said quickly. Then her mouth and eyes spread. She put a hand to her breast.
"I don't know. I didn't think so, and he said he didn't. I don't know where he was. I don't know why I never thought he might have."
"What do you think now?" Noonan asked.
He may have.
The chief winked at me, an athletic wink in which all his facial muscles took part and cast a little farther back.
And you don't know who called you up?
He wouldn't tell me his name.
Didn't recognize his voice.
No.
What kind of voice was it?
He talked in an undertone, as if afraid of being overheard. I had difficulty understanding him.
He whispered?
The chief's mouth hung open as the last sound left it. His greenish eyes sparkled greedily between their pads of fat.
Yes, a hoarse whisper.
The chief shut his mouth with a click, opened it again to say persuasively,
"You've heard Thaler talk."
The woman started and stared, big-eyed, from the chief to me.
"It was he," she cried. "It was he."
Robert Albury, the young assistant cashier of the First National Bank, was sitting in the lobby when I returned to the Great Western Hotel. We went up to my room, had some ice water brought, used its ice to put chill in scotch, lemon juice, and grenadine, and then went down to the dining room. "Now tell me about the lady," I said when we were working on the soup.
"Have you seen her yet?"
he asked.
"Not yet." "But you've heard something about her?"
"Only that she's an expert in her line."
"She is," he agreed. "I suppose you'll see her. You'll be disappointed at first. Then, without being able to say how or when it happened, you'll find you've forgotten your disappointment, and the first thing you know, you'll be telling her your life story and all your troubles and hopes."
He laughed with boyish shyness.
"And then you're caught, absolutely caught."
"Thanks for the warning. How'd you come by the information?" He grinned shamefacedly across his suspended soup spoon and confessed,
"I bought it."
"Then I suppose it cost you plenty. I hear she likes De Niro."
"She's money mad, all right. But somehow you don't mind it. She's so thoroughly mercenary, so frankly greedy, that there's nothing disagreeable about it. You'll understand what I mean when you know her."
"Maybe. Mind telling me how you happened to part with her?"
"No, I don't mind. I spent it all, that's how."
"Cold-blooded like that?" His face flushed a little. He nodded.
"You seem to have taken it well," I said. "There was nothing else to do."
The flush in his pleasant young face deepened, and he spoke hesitantly.
"It happens I owe her something for it. She... I'm going to tell you this. I want you to see this side of her. I had a little money. After that was gone... You must remember, I was young and head over heels. After my money was gone... There was the banks. I had... You don't care whether I had actually done anything or was simply thinking about it. Anyway, she found it out. I never could hide anything from her. And that was the end."
"She broke off with you?"
"Yes, thank God. If it hadn't been for her, you might be looking for me now. For embezzlement. I owe her that."
He wrinkled his forehead earnestly.
"You won't say anything about this, you know what I mean? But I want you to know she has her good side, too. You'll hear enough about the other."
"Maybe she has. Or maybe it was just that she didn't think she'd get enough to pay for the risk of being caught in a jam." He turned this over in his mind and then shook his head.
"That may have had something to do with it, but not all."
"I gathered she was strictly pay-as-you-enter."
"How about Dan Rolfe?"
he asked. "Who's he?"
"He's supposed to be her brother or half-brother or something of that sort."
"He isn't.
He's a down-and-outer, TB. He lives with her. She keeps him. She's not in love with him or anything. She simply found him somewhere and took him in."
"Any more?"
"There was that radical chap she used to run around with. It's not likely she got much money out of him."
"What radical chap?"
"He came here during the strike. Quint is his name."
"So he was on her list?"
"That's supposed to be the reason he stayed here after the strike was over."
"So he's still on her list?"
"No. She told me she was afraid of him.
He had threatened to kill her.
She seems to have had everybody on her string at one time or another, I said.
Everybody she wanted, he said,
and he said it seriously. Donald Wilson was the latest, I asked.
I don't know, he said. I had never heard anything about them, had never seen anything. The chief of police had us try to find any checks he may have issued to her before yesterday, but we found nothing. Nobody could remember ever having seen any.
Who was her last customer, so far as you know?
Lately I've seen her around town quite often with a chap named Thaler. He runs a couple of gambling houses here. They call him Whisper. You've probably heard of him.
At 8:30, I left Young Albury and set out for the Miners Hotel in Forest Street. Half a block from the hotel, I met Bill Quint.
Hello,
I hailed him.
I was on my way down to see you.
He stopped in front of me, looked me up and down, growled,
"So you're a gumshoe."
"That's the bunk," I complained. "I come all the way down here to rope you, and you're smarted up."
"What do you want to know now?"
he asked. "About Donald Wilson. You knew him, didn't you?"
"I knew him."
"Very well."
"No."
"What did you think of him?" He pursed his gray lips, by forcing breath between them, made a noise like a rag tearing, and said,
"A lousy liberal."
"You know Dinah Brand?" I asked.
"I know her."
His neck was shorter and thicker than it had been.
"Think she killed Wilson?" "Sure. It's a kick in the pants."
"Then you didn't."
"Hell yes," he said. "The pair of us together. Got any more questions?"
"Yeah, but I'll save my breath. You'd only lie to me." I walked back to Broadway, found a taxi, and told the driver to take me to 1232 Hurricane Street. Chapter 4. Hurricane Street. My destination was a gray frame cottage. When I rang the bell, the door was opened by a thin man with a tired face that had no color in it except a red spot the size of a half dollar high on each cheek. This, I thought, is the lunger Dan Rolfe. "I'd like to see Miss Brand," I told him.
"What name shall I tell her?"
His voice was a sick man's and an educated man's. "It wouldn't mean anything to her. I want to see her about Wilson's death." He looked at me with level, tired, dark eyes and said,
"Yes."
"I'm from the San Francisco office of the Continental Detective Agency. We're interested in the murder."
"That's nice of you," he said ironically. "Come in."
I went into a ground-floor room where a young woman sat at a table that had a lot of papers on it. Some of the papers were financial service bulletins, stock and bond market forecasts. One was a racing chart. The room was disorderly, cluttered up. There were too many pieces of furniture in it, and none of them seemed to be in its proper place.
"Dinah,"
the lunger introduced me. "This gentleman has come from San Francisco on behalf of the Continental Detective Agency to inquire into Mr. Donald Wilson's demise." The young woman got up, kicked a couple of newspapers out of her way, and came to me with one hand out. She was an inch or two taller than I, which made her about 5'8". She had a broad-shouldered, full-breasted, round-hipped body and big muscular legs. The hand she gave me was soft, warm, strong. Her face was the face of a girl of 25, already showing signs of wear. Little lines crossed the corners of her big, ripe mouth. Fainter lines were beginning to make nets around her thick-lashed eyes. They were large eyes, blue and a bit bloodshot. Her coarse hair, brown, needed trimming and was parted crookedly. One side of her upper lip had been rouged higher than the other. Her dress was of a particularly unbecoming wine color, and it gaped here and there down one side, where she had neglected to snap the fasteners, or they had popped open. There was a run down the front of her left stocking. This was the Dinah Brand who took her pick of Poisonville's men.
according to what I had been told. "His father sent for you, of course," she said while she moved a pair of lizard-skin slippers and a cup and saucer off a chair to make room for me. Her voice was soft, lazy. I told her the truth. "Donald Wilson sent for me. I was waiting to see him while he was being killed."
"Don't go away, Dan," she called to Rolf.
He came back into the room. She returned to her place at the table.